pod got done.
Okay. Did you? Okay, now it's going.
Senator Duncan, Senator Ewing, and I have heard this bill in state affairs. There were some changes made in state affairs that I believe none of us agreed with, and the rationale was not clear to me why they were done. There was lots of, okay, maybe it's a little clear. We didn't like that reason either. There is a proposed CS before you that would return.
You a bill from you?
That would return the bill to its pre-state affairs version. Is there someone from Representative Navarro's office here? Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tom Ackerley, sitting in for Representative Navarro. The sponsor statement that I presume that everybody has, basically, in 309, the state acts as a collector for municipalities for a personal property vehicle tax. It's an optional thing that a municipality can decide to use or not use, and the state receives a percentage of the collection for collecting. We would like to see it go back to the pre-state affairs version, needless to say. And if you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer. I mean, that's basically what the bill does. It just acts as a collector for municipalities. It's an easy way for municipalities to collect personal property vehicle tax.
Mr. Chairman, for the purposes of discussion, I'll move and ask unanimous consent that we adopt the Senate Finance Committee version. Ask unanimous consent.
Object.
Discussion.
Yeah, I just want to hear the differences. That's where I'm going.
Oh, you want to hear the differences?
Yeah, okay. Please.
Can you remember those?
Sure.
Yes. Okay.
Yes.
It was just two or three things.
Okay. First thing, one of the things on the state Senate Affairs version on page 4, it was inserted fleets would be exempted, or not exempted, they would be registered on a monthly
Your
basis.
Your pack that I'm using, excuse me.
Okay. I'm sorry, we're short a set.
That's okay, doesn't matter. I think he and I can look at this one, no problem.
And this, going back on page 4, this is one of the major changes. The fleet was going to be registered in monthly increments, and it would require the DMV to kind of trust the fleet operators to report when these vehicles are moved in and out of the state. When you look at the accompanying fiscal note, it increases it tremendously, trying to trace when these vehicles are here and when they're not here. The second thing was down at the bottom of the transition clause, where at the bottom of page 4, a municipality in which the motor vehicle registration tax was imposed may not impose this tax until the municipality meets the requirements of AS 281043A, and that's basically having an election. All the municipalities, like Kenai Peninsula Borough, for instance, they have the elected body has had by resolution adopted or said that they're going to collect this tax this way. I don't know if that's clear or not clear. I don't know what if there's something that I can. That's the three.
We're not going to do the state. Yes,
sorry. Is there someone from the municipal league here?
Yeah.
Do we have a finance commission too?
Yeah.
I oppose right now, so it's probably in here. I just took that bill right out.
This is the finance commission.
Maybe you can just briefly go through the original purpose of the bill and the changes in state affairs and then the return.
I know you'd be here. Yes, Mr. Chairman, section, are you looking at the state affairs version?
Finance.
Do you want me to go off of that or do you want to go off the CS?
No.
The new CS.
I'd like you to go off the new CS.
Right, okay.
And then explain the differences.
Okay. Then I can, what I'm doing is
That's
I'll tell
okay.
you what's not in.
Right.
Okay. There, what isn't in there is the is section one. What you have before you is section one is section two from the old version. What was taken out was a requirement that in order to put this into effect, and this is a municipal tax, an ad valorem tax, and in lieu of doing a just taxing folks, sending out a tax bill, the state collects. And the problem is, because that process is in place, the actual tax is set by statute according to a schedule. And that's what this bill does, is it changed that schedule. It updates. It has not been changed since 1978.
Okay.
So what Section 1 used to do in the state affairs that you took out required a public vote in order for this to go into effect. In other words, they couldn't continue this program unless there was a public vote.
Right, and we're taking that out.
You took that out.
Of the finance version.
Correct.
And that's what was also in the original bill, right, Scott?
Correct.
So
no. It wasn't in the original bill. Okay. It was also not in the original bill. I'm just trying to be clear as we jump back and forth. And then, as Mr. Ackley indicated, there's a section removed that used to be section 4, which dealt with the amendment that was brought in at State Affairs dealing with rental car agencies and their request that they pay a proportionate amount because they're only in the state certain number of months. The point is, in Anchorage specifically, they may bring in a fleet of 300 cars for the summer, and they felt that they should get an exemption. This bill does not deal with exemptions other than that one. I'm sure there are lots of folks that would like an exemption, but we felt that this bill dealt with the schedule and didn't deal with exemptions, and I think that's what sort of why the CS is before you. And finally, there's another section that used to be section 8, which dealt with the transition back to what I just explained about section 1, the vote. In other words, this would not go into effect until that vote occurred. So those are the three sections. They were just removed entirely. The rest of the bill remains as it has, at least when it got to state affairs. I mean, it's been amended along the way.
Questions, Mr. Bridges?
Yes.
Senator Adams.
This bill deals with also car rentals. But what about trucking association? Will this tax be passed on to the consumers?
Mr. Chairman, I'm glad to respond to that if you would. This would affect all vehicles as listed, which would include trucks, and to the degree they're commercial vehicles, I assume that in any, as the cost of business goes, it's passed on to the consumers. But this is for a municipal tax to pay for municipal services, roads, which those trucks and vehicles drive on, the police to enforce the traffic laws, whatever it may be.
I would call members' attention, back in your packet somewhere, there's a table called Local Policy on Taxation Motor Vehicles, and it spells out what various municipalities do. Not everybody collects the tax, clearly, so it just applies to those municipalities that want to, that have opted to participate in
it. And it pays more than pays for itself in terms of a straight dollar volume. Whether that money comes back to the legislature, obviously, and it's up to you to appropriate. But this bill does increase that 5% to 8%, which would be 8% of an increased amount. So, in fact, brings in even more. Obviously, 5% of something more is more money, but 8% of that larger number is even more.
Of the numbers of cities, how many cities collect this tax themselves, and how many let the state do it?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Adams, only two municipalities do actual full and true value. That's the Bristol Bay Borough and the North Slope Borough. Several municipalities that have property tax, we're only dealing with municipalities that have property tax, exempt them outright, like Juneau. And then there's almost an equal number, I guess, that use the state-collected system.
Nine. I was wondering if there's, Mr. Chairman, any way we can have just the various municipalities collect this. If you look at the first fiscal note, you'll see they need 7 full-time employees in 93,
yeah,
and then 4 after that, and so.
Maybe the person from Public Safety can address that question, because there is, again, in the bill, I would call your attention to page 3, line 23. That's the money to pay for the collection that comes from the fees, and that is being, maybe, make room here.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Juanita Hensley. I'm with Division Motor Vehicles. To answer Senator Adams' question, the House version of the fiscal note from Department of Public Safety, as you can see, there is 8% revenue sources coming in. on the House version, as well as 8% coming in on the State Affairs version of the fiscal note that was just prepared. The difference of the 7 positions that we were requesting is because of the rental car companies being allowed to prorate a vehicle registration. That is going to impact the Division of Motor Vehicles immensely if that provision is left in statute. We are very much opposed to proration. We don't feel like it should be listed to just a special interest group such as car rental agencies. If you're going to exempt people and allow prorating, then individuals who only only drive their cars in the summer, you know, they would be also subject to that same thing, that same rule. And it would impact the Division of Motor Vehicles greatly, sir. The House version that we asked for, those positions were zeroed out in House Finance. So basically it is the amount of revenue that was coming in, and that's all that the Division of Motor Vehicles it was not allowed to have those positions, even though we do feel that the original version of the bill that passed the House will impact the Division of Motor Vehicles as well.
Mr. Chairman, let me make sure that what we're adopting here is almost the original bill, isn't it?
That is correct.
It is the original bill that was
that passed
the way it came over before we put the special interest exemption on in State Affairs. And what you're saying, Mr. Chairman, is that, and I assume Representative Navarre supports this, right? Right, he supports this. What you're saying is that we're just going to take the revenue on the fiscal note that came out of the House Finance Committee. It could be the same fiscal note can be applied to this then, right?
The
so it's essentially a revenue-generating fiscal note. Can you tell me what the date of that fiscal note is that's in my file there?
The date of the last fiscal note that was prepared for the House version of the bill was 2/21 of 92, or signed off by 2/27 of 92.
Okay, and so we disregard this one from Burton, from Mr. Burton that had the three motor vehicle reps that were on there.
So it was my understanding that the House was just zeroed out the positions for the first year.
Well, I'm sure I have it here somewhere, so.
Mr. Chairman, if I can make another statement. The three positions that we asked for were for the first year. The Division of Motor Vehicles felt that even with the House version of this bill, the Division of Motor Vehicles will still have an impact of people coming in and complaining. They are going to review this motor vehicle registration tax or the increase of it, not a municipal tax, but a state tax. And we felt that that was going to slow down the lines and the processing of individual registration and titling, and that's the reason we requested three positions.
Additional questions, Senator?
Going on looking at Section 6, 7, and 8 and the effective dates, would you help me understand the trigger and effect of Section 1 and 3 effect January 1st, 1993, Section 2, January 1st, 1994, Section 4 and 5, January 1st, 1997, please. How does this work, please?
Okay, I would probably prefer Mr. Burgess answering that if possible.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Adams, this the data shows basically this is a 70% increase over 2 years. The first year is 35%.
Okay.
The second year is 35%. And then there is a 1 year. After 3 years, it stays at that 70% increase. A 3 year, it stays at that. At the end of that, there's a one-time increase, CPI increase, and then it stays at that unless the legislature changes it. When the bill was originally introduced, rather than having to come back and change the schedule every year or whatever year that it affects, we were trying to put in a CPI in there, but people didn't like that. They said, let's see the CPI work once. Let's see if it goes up or down or how much it goes up, and then we'll worry about it, whether we want to do something later. So it's that staging of the two-year process. Then there's and then after that sunset, in other words, it sunsets after that one CPI, which would be 5 years down the road. And that's
98.
And that would be it would sunset, that CPI would sunset, and therefore it would stay at that amount until the legislature changes it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Further questions?
No further questions.
There was a motion before you.
Was there a further objection to the adoption?
I'll remove my objection for that.
Then the finance CS will be adopted.
Did anybody of you three have further testimony? Were there others in the audience wanting to testify on 309?
Mr. Chairman, I just want to make a statement, and I've talked to Mr. Burgess and Mr. Representative. I still have problems with the bill, but I'm willing to move it out. It's a tax. The next to have concerns, a tax. So. Like all the rest of the bills we've got, but not just that. But I would move it out with individual recommendations, and then we'll have more discussion.
Objection to the motion? If not, the new CS finance for House Bill 309 moves from committee with individual recommendations and the accompanying fiscal note dated 2/28/92. The next bill before us is, let's see. Okay, how about, Okay. We're going to hopefully take an easy one here, and then we can be back to the bill. Let's try House Bill 155. House Bill 155, Mr. Myers.
Is this the tobacco bill?
No, we're going to hold to the
tobacco road.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Eric Myers, staff for Representative Brown. Fundamentally, House Bill 155 is offered as an attempt to put into place a process by which public facilities and places of public accommodation can be brought into compliance with the Federal Americans with Disabilities Act. The Americans with Disabilities Act was signed into law by President George Bush on July 26, 1990. This legislation has a broad-ranging impact across the country and will have a substantial impact on Alaska as well. Fundamentally, the law is a civil rights law that prohibits discrimination against persons with disabilities, and as part of the federal law will require that facility owners, both within public on the public side as well as on the private side, examine their facilities to determine what alterations might be needed in order to make those facilities accessible or barrier-free. The proposed legislation would establish a financing mechanism by which state public facilities, as well as places of public accommodation as covered under the federal law, could be brought into compliance. The scope and magnitude of the kinds of investments that will be required as a consequence of the facility assessments that will be necessitated by this law is not well defined. You may have noted in the capital budget that the administration has proposed both a handful of specific capital projects for barrier-free access improvements, as well as an appropriation for statewide facility assessments. This legislation would establish two accounts within the general fund, a barrier-free barrier-free remodeling assistance fund that you'll see on the bottom of page 2, line 30, as well as on page 3, line 8, a barrier-free remodeling revolving loan fund. The purpose of the legislation is to establish these two accounts and put in place an orderly process by which statewide facility needs can be determined and prioritized. Agencies are directed to come forward with lists of projects identified through the facility assessment process and to work through the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities in concert with the Governor's Committee on Employment of People with Disabilities to come up with a prioritized listing of project needs. It is anticipated that in the future, next year, that the legislature can consider the prioritized projects and make appropriate allocations to meet the state facility remodeling needs, as well as House Bill 155, as well as provide, as appropriate in the judgment of the legislature, financial assistance to local governments and other public entities, as well as through loans to private entities that are caught within the requirements of the ADA. And I'd be happy to answer questions at this time.
You want to speak to the fiscal notes?
There are there are three fiscal notes that were prepared. The Governor's Committee on Employment of People of the Governor's Committee on Employment of People with Disabilities prepared a $65,000 fiscal note. The Department of Transportation also had a fiscal note in the amount of believe it's $149,000, and the Division of Investments had a fiscal note in the amount of, I think it's $8,000. There was a memo, I believe, that's in your packet, which suggests that they be treated in the following manner, that the Governor's Committee on Employment of People with Disabilities, that fiscal note be eliminated, and that the funding requirements for their participation in the facility assessment and ranking process be addressed through an allocation within the capital budget. The the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities fiscal note could be reduced to $75,000 to provide the ability to get the program established. And the recommendation on the third fiscal note is that it be adopted. The Division of Investments, it was $8,000. The memo that we provided did have a draft suggested DOTPF fiscal note for the committee's consideration. I have consulted with the Department of Transportation. There's a representative here if you'd like to hear from the department.
Okay. Questions on the fiscal notes?
Yes, Chairman. I do have questions of you, Mr. Chairman. Some of this dollars is needed in the capital bill, and I just wondered what was the pleasure. Are we going to do it in the fiscal note, or are we going to do it in the capital budget?
The first suggestion is actually easier than it may sound. This is something that we would propose in the capital budget. The Department of Transportation has a general allocation for looking into handicap facilities pursuant to the ADA, and we would propose reallocating that lump sum into some for coordination specifically with the Governor's Committee, and then leave the balance for DOT, and that is something that we would pursue. The other suggestions, I would certainly be open for reducing the DOT fiscal note according to the suggestions made here. And did you say what did you propose for the third fiscal note?
The third fiscal note is the Division of Investments, and I believe it's $6,900 in order to enable them to prepare regulations and disseminate information about the requirements of the ADA.
Oh.
I would propose that be adopted. That would be the recommendation.
Okay. Is there someone here from DAPA?
Chairman Roger Allington. I'm the chief engineer for the Department of Transportation. Mr. Rod Wilson, who's been working on this, is one of my subordinates, and I will provide whatever information I can at this point.
Does the department or the administration have a position on the bill?
Well, I believe there's a position paper that says we support the bill. I think the only thing that I need to say is that we have a GF general fund section in the fiscal note, which was to be available under HB 155 to develop regulations, and then we'd identified additional funding, which was assumed to come from 157, if 157 passed, for additional work in this area. I don't believe we have a problem. We would, of course, prefer that in the capital budget, the $200,000 be in, and we do an RSA with the Governor's Committee, but it's not a major issue.
Questions of the department?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I have some questions. First of all, just had a chance to look at the DOT fiscal note on it. What I'm interested in is looking at the bill is that, first of all, we have to follow the regulation. We have to go and take the federal law, and we have a new federal law on this disabilities thing and how we have to change door handles, all the different aspects of it. And yet, I guess we're going to try to eliminate the DOT fiscal note, either eliminate it completely or reduce it from what's here. A lot of this stuff you have to comply with under the federal law anyway, don't you?
I would say that essentially we have to comply with it. If we do not have the ability to comply with it, that's a different issue.
But I applaud Representative Brown for doing this bill, don't get me wrong. I just wonder how much of this we really need to have to go under the federal law. That's all. I mean, the federal law is pretty far-reaching already, is it not? And what are we doing under that right now? How much federal funding are we getting for that? I mean, there's money that's budgeted for that, I assume.
Through the chair, I am not aware of any federal funds that are budgeted for this. One of the problems with the ADA Act is that there are specific regulations to be developed or under which decisions will be made through the judicial system. That's one of the problems with the ADA Act. We have tried to take the position of developing this through 155, we would develop regulations, which would assist in defining what ADA means in Alaska, hopefully with the result that those would withstand the judicial test. But at this point, we're not guaranteed that our regulations would withstand the judicial test.
Mr. Chairman, if I might add, there are no federal funds provided for compliance with the ADA, and it's important to keep in mind that the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, is not a building code, it's a civil rights law, and it establishes essentially an obligation on the part of both building owners and operators within the public sector as well as in the private sector that they may not discriminate and that they must make their facilities accessible to the physically disadvantaged within reasonable parameters, and those are being worked out at the federal level through regulations. Fundamentally, this legislation is an attempt to put in place an orderly process by which the state can address its own facility compliance needs, and the scope and extent and expense of making those accommodations is not yet well defined. Suffice it to say that there's going to be some significant expenses, but the facility assessments that are specifically required will determine to what extent specific accommodations must be made.
Was there anybody else desiring to testify on the bill?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to hold the bill over for until tomorrow morning. I just want to make sure that I understand it all properly.
Maybe we'll hold it over for tomorrow morning.
I would like to look at the fiscal.
I want to take a look at that, and we do it in the morning.
You can look at the memo from Representative Brown in context where she runs through the suggested changes in the fiscal note. Why don't we, as long as we have Senator Schultz here and Mr. Myers, why don't you just sit there? Thank you very much. Let's turn back to HB 84 and see if we can finish up this our work on that bill.
If I may, we have reached, I believe, concurrence on this. The only amendment, and then I'll get to that in a second, is amendment number two, and it just has to do with the degree by which, a person, one is easier to prove, then it becomes more difficult. But anyway, in the first section, I'm asking that section be deleted, and it's just the finding section.
Senator Schultz, I'm on amendment number two.
He's got amendment number one.
Yeah. I thought you said amendment number two.
Yeah.
Okay, I went to number two just to say that's where the only problem there is. Okay. I'll explain these very briefly.
Okay.
In the first one, I'm asking that we delete section number one. It has to do with the findings. In reading through the findings, I don't exactly concur, and there's a lot of people that do agree, but I don't agree with all of the findings, because I believe that cigarettes right now taxed at the level they're taxed bring in far more money than it costs in the medical facilities. These people are taxpayers also. They also pay for medical insurance and so on and so forth. So and they agree that the finding is not necessary.
I think that we could debate all the points, but we don't need to. It's not a material as far as the implementation of the legislation is concerned. We can live with the deletion of the findings.
Motion?
Yes, I would move amendment number one.
Is your objection? Not amendment number one adopted.
Okay. Amendment number two, there was knowingly was in law. They replaced it with negligently. And negligently is easier to show that you negligently did something, and I replaced it with intentionally. And
can you negligently and intentionally do it at the same time, Senator Schultz?
You could be negligent, okay?
And be intentional about it.
Yeah, you could.
Then why don't we put both in?
I think these are terms of legal law. I'm not sure intentional is a legal law. I know knowingly, negligently, those are terms of...
I would put knowingly. That's what was in law.
Can you be knowingly, intentionally, negligently doing it all at the same time?
You would have to ask an attorney that. I would say yes.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, this is really the heart of the bill, and there was a very deliberate choice on the part of the sponsor to propose negligence as the standard for guilt in the case of persons committing the offense of selling or giving tobacco. The practical reality right now is that the standard is knowingly, and it is unenforceable. As a practical matter, if someone is charged with selling tobacco, they simply can assert that they didn't know that the person was underage. Even if they look like they're 12 years old, the standard is so high that under current law, the definitions are found at 1181-900, it requires that the person be aware and that be demonstrable and a burden on the enforcement agent. Negligence is a different standard, although a rigorous standard. It is the same standard that persons who are licensed to sell alcohol are held to when they are dispensing alcohol. It's essentially the standard that a barkeep or a package liquor store vendor would face. Essentially, it requires that the person who is selling alcohol, or under the terms of this, selling tobacco, would be required to exercise care that a reasonable person would observe in the situation. In fact, it's even more rigorous than that. They would have to be guilty of a gross deviation from the standard of care. If there is to be any meaningful deterrence and enforcement under this law, negligence is really the only standard that makes any sense. I would, on behalf of Representative Brown, speak strongly in opposition to this proposed amendment and request that it not be adopted.
I object to that amendment then.
Yeah, and that's fine. I will ask that then intentionally be scratched out and knowingly put back in. That is something that's already defined, knowingly and negligently is already defined.
I think Mr. Myers was speaking to knowingly.
Mm-hmm.
Either intentionally, the culpable states of mind scheme that's articulated at 1181-900 has different states of mind. Intentionally is the highest, knowingly is next. And criminal negligence or negligence is the next standard.
Right.
If either knowingly or intentionally were kept in this bill, it would, as a practical matter, obviate the usefulness of the legislation.
Motion.
I would move amendment number two with knowingly.
Discussion. All those in favor, raise your hand. Opposed. Motion carries. That returns to knowingly.
Okay. Amendment number three, and we're just saying not open to the public, and I cited some examples. I don't need to go into them, but I gave an example of a large employer that has a break room, things of this nature, which is not generally considered a public area or a public place. There are places that are accessible to the public that are not public places. Teacher lounge. If you take a distribution center, Napa distribution center, for example, in Anchorage, they have a break room for their employees, 35, 50 of them. It's not generally open to the public. It's accessible.
Is that in Polk or here?
That's in Anchorage.
Oh.
Anchorage, yeah.
Mr. Myers, comments?
Well, it's not an amendment that the sponsor is particularly enthusiastic about. It doesn't do a great deal of violence to the bill, but it does weaken it some.
Object.
You're not talking about size or anything on the signs?
No, it's just, well, what they're saying is not open to the public. There are a lot of break areas. I'll just take it, for example, a teacher's lounge is not a public area, okay? But the public is not denied access. Yeah, but the public is not denied access. That's all I'm saying. You have a lot of places where adults work. I move the amendment.
Discussion on the motion? Objection to the motion?
I object.
All those in favor of the motion, raise your hand. Opposed? Motion carries.
Okay. Amendment number four, and I thought we had some concurrence on this. I don't know, but delete the word "shall" and insert the word "may."
Line 28.
Line 28 on amendment number four, page 3. They have it in statute exactly. If you're guilty of this, this is what happens to you.
I'm on page 3, line 28.
Something's wrong with this.
Yeah, there's not. It's not following what we got.
Page
here.
3, line.
What's a different line?
Line 26, I'm sorry.
26.
Page 3, okay. Line 26.
26, correct. 26.
The word "shall."
Okay, now, Senator Schultz, you know that is existing law.
That's correct.
You're changing existing law?
That's correct.
Well, you're working the law that's now on the books.
That's correct.
Well, that's even worse. She's going to have a worse bill than when we started.
No, not at all. It allows more flexibility. It allows more flexibility in this whole process.
But you may have the vote. So
Mr. Yeah. Myers?
Well, I too thought we'd had a concurrence of opinion extending back to amendment number two. Unfortunately, may have misunderstood. This would weaken the bill. I mean, it would weaken the existing law. You're absolutely correct. And again, as a suite of amendments or as a package of amendments, if amendment number two were not adopted, that would be palatable. If amendment number two is in fact adopted as amended by Senator Schultz, there probably isn't a whole lot of utility in pursuing the rest of the legislation.
Mr. Chairman, I would, in kindness to the person that's worked on this, I will back up to amendment two and ask that we go with negligently, and ask unanimous consent.
There's been a motion to rescind our action in adopting amendment number two. Is there objection?
Okay.
Then the language would return to negligently.
No, I would move amendment number four.
Is there objection to amendment number four?
No.
If not, amendment number four is adopted.
And amendment number five, again, it allows the flexibility only for the department or for the court to make a decision, but up to 45 days, next one up to 90.
Now, are we weakening, Mr. Chairman, we're weakening the bill here again?
No.
Are you going to say that on the record?
You can give them 45 days, you can give them 90 days.
Okay.
But it's, you give the courts the flexibility.
Mr. Myers?
It's, it would make it a permissive rather than mandatory thing, and in the context of this amendment package, there's no objection.
No objection.
That's a motion. Is there an objection to the adoption of amendment number five? It's not amendment number five, it's adopted.
And amendment number six is very simple. It speaks to, you have it?
Oh, got it.
Okay. There's a section in there that's really, in my opinion, kind of corny because it speaks to supervising a vending machine. Okay, and I don't care what attorney drafted that up. That is not
that
correct.
That's corny as some of your amendments.
Okay. And all this does is defines supervise. In this chapter, it means reasonably monitor the use of.
Mr. Myers?
No objection.
I'll take that as a motion.
Yes.
Is there objection to the adoption of amendment number six? If not, so adopted. So all the amendments 1, 3, 4, 5, and 6 were adopted. Is there a motion to incorporate those in a new committee CS?
I would move that we incorporate the amendments into a new committee substitute.
Is there objection? Is there objection to the adoption of new finance CS incorporating the adopted amendments?
And I would move committee substitute for House Bill 84 from committee with individual recommendation.
Is there objection to the motion? If not, the new finance CS for 84 moves from committee with individual recommendations and the accompanying fiscal notes. Thank you very much. Thank you, sir. Virginia Collins, Senator Collins, you've been waiting patiently. For what bill?
Well,
great to ask.
243.
Do I have my choice or do I...
campaign finance.
Well, we're a little...
Maybe you, can,
I apologize.
Maybe you can tell us why we have Senate bills on the calendar at this date.
That's a really good question, Mr. Chairman.
These are low numbers.
I can assure you I worked really hard to get them out of committee, but it had to go through the special committee on ethics of Senate Bill 243. We'll try that one on for size. And
243.
This is a bill that was introduced by the Senate Committee on Ethics. So at the start of the session, we decided that rather than doing an omnibus bill, that we would have two separate bills, one a campaign financing bill, the other the ethics bill, which is Senate Bill 185. Senate Bill 243 that you have before you, although it's probably been a while since you've seen them, I'm sure that many of the items in it are not new because the items, many of the items for the bill were taken from previous House previous bills that had passed the Senate and had passed the House but never had passed the legislature as a whole. I don't know if you want a sectional by section analysis on the bill or if you just...
No, we do have a sectional. I do recognize many of those. Some of them I've forgotten about.
Can I give you some highlights?
Certainly.
Okay. One of the things that it does is it adds a requirement to the Alaska Public Offices Commission to issue advisory opinions similar to the Select Committee on Ethics. And one of the problems that candidates have is that they will call APOC and get some instructions on how to handle a matter. And then they do it, and then the commission turns around and either enters another opinion or there's a problem with it later. What this does is puts a mechanism in place that is similar to the advisory opinions that we get with respect to ethics. And once they issue an opinion or recommendation, it is an advisory opinion, and the candidate can count on the fact that that isn't going to change. We have a prohibition here for the use of public facilities and employees and equipment to influence the outcome of elections. other than providing a neutral position on a ballot position. We have a prohibition that would make it impossible for a candidate to contribute to another candidate out of their campaign funds. It would have any contributions made to another candidate would have to be personal funds. We have a provision for municipalities and school districts that would not allow them to make contributions to candidates. And we have a provision that requires a closing campaign accounts and lists the way the funds can be distributed. This is comes in part from the previous bills that were passed with respect to campaign financing. And I believe a version of this has passed the Senate in the past. And it requires complaints that are filed to be under oath, and the investigations remain confidential until the probable cause is determined. And those are basically the highlights of the bill and things that should be brought to your attention. But I think you've seen most of these provisions in one form or another. It's not an aggressive change to the campaign financing law. It's primarily a clarification restatement with a few added things.
Could you say in this piece of legislation that there are a number of requirements have been deleted from APOC's workloads?
Not in this bill. The bill that we're talking about is Senate Bill 299, and in that bill, some of the reporting that is required that hasn't been done is deleted, and there are some functions that are deleted from APOC and Senate Bill 299, but that's not the case for Senate Bill 243. Okay.
If that's the case in that other bill, then we need to look at the fiscal note if some of the requirements are deleted.
Mr. Chairman, sir, I don't have any problems with this, but given our financial condition, it seems as though we've been placing less and less importance on APOC because we've been funding them less and less, and this calls for additional funding, and I don't know what's going to happen if we go ahead and enact this legislation and it looks as though the legislature is on the verge in the next couple of years of eliminating APOC.
Well, hopefully not. There was some... have you looked at the effective dates in light of the passing of another year?
No, I haven't, Mr. Chairman, and perhaps there need to be some adjustment on those.
I think so. I think the effective date would kind of come in the middle of this year's campaign season.
Is there...
I have no objection to having the effective dates updated, Mr. Chairman.
And I'd also call the members' attention to the position paper of the APOC. They point out a few things of, I don't know, concern or of, that, I can't find it now. Have you looked at their letters?
Yes, I have looked at the bill. They didn't really, when they testified, when the bill was up, we didn't get really much testimony from them. We got a late position paper in 1992 after it had passed the Special Committee on Ethics, and they did have some concerns. I looked through them, and I don't think there's any, you know, real big problem with their concerns, but if there's anything in particular that you wish to address, I'd be happy to accept an amendment.
Okay. Ms. Miles, Brooke Miles, has been kind of hanging fire all day. I don't see her.
I think she's left.
Yeah. And
I see her at
4:30. Don't really. I mean, we've been kind of catch-as-catch-can all day, so.
Yeah, it's tough to get people.
Administration.
Okay. Was there anybody else desiring to testify in 243? Ms. Burgess?
Mr. Chairman, Scott Burgess, Alaska Municipal League. Very, I hope, minor issue. We've raised it before in previous committees. It deals with the use of public funds section. In 243, the issue here is that municipal or state funds should not be used.
Where are you reading now? Page 4?
Page 6. Page 6, section 1513078. Public spending prohibited. You have section A and B, lines 8 through 18. I would suggest using language, and I didn't write this up as amendment, I did talk to your staff, the language in 195, which is the companion bill or a companion bill on the other side, to me has similar language, clearer language. We're not a concern in terms of influencing spending money on a candidate, but the ballot proposition issue is one in which municipal funds or public funds could be spent,
right,
for example, on a solid waste study that came up with the conclusion that you needed to build an incinerator, which you'd have to put on a ballot measure for a bonding issue, that you want to put out information. You spent maybe $300,000 on the study just to sort of leave it up in the air. Again, we would like it not to say that you can't do that, but we realize, I mean, the other committees have said, no, we don't think you should be spending money for or against a ballot proposition. The problem I've got with the existing language is it says you may not, first of all, starts out to influence. I mean, influence at all, positive, negative, or whatever, and then goes on to talk about neutral information. I have copies of the 195 language, and basically it says cannot use public funds to support or oppose a ballot proposition as opposed to influence.
Right.
And then goes on to say does not prohibit the expenditure of public funds to provide the public factual information. Doesn't use the word neutral, which to me is just going to lead to litigation unnecessarily when the attempt is to put out information, again, not to support or oppose, but it may influence the decision. If the facts influence the decision, so be it. And that's the only concern that, I mean, at this point, I think the language is clear, would provide for public information being to be sent out and not rest on what one side may say against an issue. And that's the only thing I offer. Again, otherwise I don't have a problem with the bill and don't want this to hold it up. But.
Well, we went through this in the committee and went through several kind of versions, and I thought at the time that we did change the original language to try to accommodate the concerns of the municipality. I guess I don't have the discomfort that Mr. Burgess has, but I'll defer to the committee on how they wish to handle this section.
Other people desiring to comment on this? We've lost our quorum, and the conference committee's meeting, I don't think.
I know we've lost our quorum. I mean, yeah. Is there a bill that's over here now that's like this? Or,
no.
This is just.
Can you tell us about the House?
I'm sorry, I can't tell you, but I'm not really familiar with the House bill. It has gone through quite a change as it's gone through its process, so I've lost track of it, and I'm not sure exactly.
Where's the House bill?
It's in Finance.
House Finance.
What I would suggest is that if members could look through this, and I mean, it is, I think, a lot of old material. I think we just need to read through it, refresh ourselves. We'll get Ms. Miles from APOC tomorrow, prepare perhaps an amendment for the committee's considerations along the lines that Mr. Burgess was talking about, anything else that, and the effective dates, and see if we can dispense with the bill tomorrow. Did you have any comments on, now this, the 299 is the governor's
bill. 299 is the governor's bill. It's basically more of a cleanup language type bill. It has primarily, it makes some changes, and deletes some of a few of the small things that the APOC does. It exempts any campaign that raises and spends less than $1,000. It excludes or exempts them from campaign reporting. It makes some minor changes with respect to the civil penalties for late filing. It makes minor changes in reporting for both APOC and lobbyists, and it just changes some of the dates and does away with some of the reports that they've never been collecting anyway. And it raised the disclosure of threshold for sources of income from $1,000 and adds a new provision which requires disclosure of gifts over $100 as a source of income. And it exempts municipal officials from population areas of less than 1,000 from conflict of interest disclosure reports. The only change that I would make since this bill passed out of judiciary would be on page 5, line 3, after person to put a period there and delete the new language, was accept that a source of income that is a gift must be included if the value of the gift exceeds $100. One of the things that we need to do is take this out of this piece of legislation so that it will conform with the ethics bill that is in the process of being hopefully passed.
I'm sorry, would you repeat that again?
Well, on page 5 of Senate Bill 299, on line 3, the new language added by the bill was accept that a source of income that is a gift must be included if the value of the gift exceeds $100. The concern here was that people were concerned that if this language were left in, that I guess we didn't think of it at the time, but that if you got a Christmas gift from your spouse or that was in excess of 100, that you'd have to report it. So we're doing some different language in the ethics bill to clarify the legal
distinction.
So we don't need that. We don't need that
just
line.
Just the subsection 1.
Yeah, so you can just delete that.
Okay. And is there some, do you view any of these as controversial?
No, none of the
substantial in any
not way? Really. Not really. It's really basically just more of a little cleanup thing. It's not.
Would you see any problem with putting that on the other bill?
None whatsoever.
Because that, at this stage, that might be an easier thing.
I would have
to do.
No objection to that. Just okay. Put it in there.
And then again, we'll try to get APOC here to comment on this.
And here she is.
Oh, Ms. Miles.
Hi.
Welcome.
Join us at the
table. Do you want to join us here?
Mr. Chairman,
sure.
I have a question.
We discussed Senate Bill 243
and 299. We're going to try to go both of them at the same time.
Oh, that's all right. He had gone over your position paper, and we had gone over some of the areas of concern, but maybe you need to address them in particular.
We're really on both bills, Ms. Miles. Either you can start with 243 and then 299 if you want to take your coat off.
Thank you. I'm sorry, I'm late.
No problem.
Mr. Chairman, my name's Brooke Miles. I'm the Juneau Branch Administrator for the Public Offices Commission. The Commission, Senate Bill 243, the Commission has reviewed and they believe that this measure is in the public's interest. We did have several concerns which were addressed in our April 13 position paper. I believe the members have in their packets. And we also have the fiscal note attached, which indicates that the Commission believes that it will need significant regulatory work and additional staff for administering and enforcing the new measures.
For which particular measures?
Particularly the parts of fundraising limitations, the public building prohibitions, and
public
the
building prohibitions?
The prohibitions against raising money or accepting contributions in a public building. In section 2, page 2. And the other one was The prohibition on public spending.
And where's that?
Page 6, line 8.
That's the section Scott Burgess just discussed.
Section 8, I had some concerns about that as well.
Washington State has a campaign finance law which includes a provision prohibiting public spending, including municipality spending on behalf of ballot propositions, and they spend 90% of their enforcement resources on that area of the law. It is.
Mr. Chairman, on Section 8, since we're on that, I guess we're talking essentially here from the sectional analysis from Senator Collins, dated the 7th here, that the candidate, this goes on, it says, first, a candidate or group controlled by a candidate did not make a contribution to another candidate except from the candidate's personal funds. So in other words, if the Pat Pichot election campaign wanted to give $100 to the $250 to the Right to Life campaign, they couldn't do that. Is that right?
That's good.
Well, one other question while we're in loans, there isn't anything in here that prohibits someone that puts their own money into a campaign and then they show it as a loan, that they could try to extract that money at some later point.
No, there's not.
Has that been considered? That if someone wants to put their own personal money into a campaign, I guess that's their prerogative under the United States law, or I guess under the, this was decided in a court case.
Right, Buckley Vallejo.
Right, exactly, very good. And so if that's the case, they can do that, but if they're going to put that in of their own money, there should be some kind of prohibition that someone can't go retrieve that money back out later on. If they put $100,000, as an example, let's say they have a lot of money, and they put $100,000 of their own money into the campaign, and then they fill out a form and say, this is a loan, I want to get it repaid. I mean, is it possible that you could, if they put it in, that's their prerogative, but I don't think it's fair for them to then extract it back out again just by being able to go through the APOC regulations and fill out a loan form?
Well,
or does that happen? I don't know.
No, under current law, candidates' personal contributions are never reported as loans and always considered to be as a loan, but in fact a candidate can retrieve that money from his campaign at any point.
And Mr. Chairman, under the law right now, can they do that or can they not after the campaign's over?
Yes, they can.
Is there anything in the law that you're working on, the ethics law, that would prohibit that right now?
No, there's not.
I thought we had a bill we worked on that where that was prohibited.
I believe it's been addressed in a previous bill, but we did not address it in this one or in the ethics law.
One of the questions I had on page 4, number L, where you say a candidate for the legislature, including an incumbent legislator, may not solicit or accept contributions during legislative session. I have never understood the ethical concern of a non-legislator having a fundraiser during the legislative session. I mean, that makes no sense at all to me. They have no juice, they're not chairing committees, they have no bills, what's the point of it?
The point, I believe, Mr. Chairman, was to satisfy the House, which felt that that they wanted to put the same limitations on the candidates that they did on the incumbents, because the ethics legislation prohibits any sitting legislator from raising or accepting any money whatsoever during session or special session, and so I think their concern has been that you need to balance that so that candidates who are not legislators can not do any fundraising during the.
Well, as they say, that sounds like a personal problem. That doesn't sound like a public problem. I fail to grasp what the public purpose of that is, unless you just want to enhance the power of incumbents. But I think we've all started out sometime. I mean, this doesn't say in Juneau even. This is anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So people are filing for office in June. They've never been in the legislature before. They
yeah, it's
file for office in March, and they want to get started, and they can't hold a fundraiser because the legislature's in session. It's not like they're going to shake down anybody. I mean, I don't understand why, except if you want to just disadvantage your opponents or potential opponents.
I think that was the purpose of it.
And Mr. Chairman, with respect to that section that you were talking about, the commission did have a question under sub 2 where it speaks to member, which doesn't seem to correspond with a candidate for the legislator or an incumbent legislator.
The member.
On line 29. But should probably say candidate.
But in the ethics bill, then, as I understand it, Senator Collins, that is all, that is already covered in the ethics bill. Is that correct?
That's correct. With respect to legislators, it's already covered in the ethics bill.
Did you have other comments?
On the same page, if we may, on page 4, in section 8, subsection I, the commission was concerned that shared campaign activity wouldn't always be allowed as it currently is. Mr. Chairman, under current law, when two candidates decide to share a fundraiser, sometimes, and this is of course a policy call, one candidate is able to pay a greater share, which is then considered to be a contribution to that candidate's campaign. And it couldn't be more than $1,000.
Senator Dueling had asked or used an example of contributing to Right to Life. I read that as candidate, not necessarily group or party or... Is that your reading of that? It's only a candidate?
Yes.
I mean, could you contribute to the Republican Party or Democratic Party?
I believe it speaks to...
Could you buy a raffle ticket with your campaign funds from the Democratic Party?
I believe it speaks to candidates in controlled groups, which is, of course, a group controlled by the candidate. So
I see.
Yeah. That makes some sense. Other comments?
There's one more comment, Mr. Chairman. One of the differences between the House bill, the House ethics bill, and the Senate ethics bill was that in the House ethics bill, there was a defense fund provision that would allow a legislator who was charged either civilly or criminally to raise essentially unlimited amounts of money in order to defend themselves. The policy decision that the Senate Special Committee on Ethics made was that there wasn't support for it in the committee, but if it did happen anywhere, it should happen in the campaign financing bill as opposed to the ethics bill. So that's a compromise that we've made with the House, and that we've taken the defense fund out of the ethics bill. I do believe that the House has an interest in putting the defense fund back into the bill, and I'll leave that.
And Mr. Chairman, they're going to do that in this bill. Is this where they want all this to happen?
Yes, they'd like to have the campaign fund, which was deleted from the ethics bill, put back into the campaign finance.
That is it. I mean, I have to sympathize. People get themselves caught in these situations, regardless of whether they were wronged or doing it. People, you're literally trapped. You can't raise money. Mm-hmm. You can't use money. You can hardly do anything relative to your own defense, mm-hmm. except use all your personal money.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, the policy decision that the Senate Select Committee on Ethics made was that if we are sued for anything that we have done as a legislator, we are covered by risk management. We are not covered if we have committed a crime or if we have been, caused damage to someone and it's not mm-hmm. consistent with, out of the realm of our legislative work. And that's the reason that we didn't include it. I'll defer to the committee on the inclusion. That is a request of the House to include that in this bill.
Okay, now, if they wanted to include it, is it something that fits under, it sure fits under the title, I assume, right?
I believe it does.
Okay. Additional comments, questions? Is there anybody else desiring to testify on either one of these bills?
Mr. Casey is here. He's a drafter of the bill. Is he here?
Yeah.
Do you have any comments, Mr. Casey? Have you overlooked anything or made any errors?
I don't think he's made any errors.
Of course not. Of course not. That's the right answer.
Not if you wrote it, huh?
Yeah. I could answer questions.
Well, I'm sure I'll have some questions, but I think we've lost our committee for the evening.
Yeah.
But,
maybe we could work on some effective date language. You wake. Maybe we can work with. I think we need some effective date language that conforms to something that, other than the middle of the campaign this year. And I think what we want to do is take a look at some of your comments and some of the other concerns that have been expressed here. Maybe roll both bills together, give a chance for people to read the thing a little bit, and hopefully do something here tomorrow on it.
Mr. Chairman, will you be meeting tomorrow morning?
Yeah, we will be meeting. We don't know. I think we're going to have to find out. It'll be subject to the call of the chair. We're waiting for the conference committee and to see when they adjourn to Senator Ewing. I don't be nice to say 8 o'clock in the morning, but yeah, if they meet at 8 o'clock, we're back in the same problem.
I really appreciate all the work you've done on this. Yeah. It's just, I don't know how it's ever going to pass this yeah. year. But
unless they're unless waiting for God it comes with down. Open arms or something.
It's taking 3 days to get something passed.
Thank you all.
We stand.
Who is waiting for it? Okay. We'll stand adjourned. Subject to a call of the chair, we will be meeting tomorrow to finish the calendars. Take up a few bills. We're not going to get to most of the bills tonight. We've got some things that we really need to do. We're waiting for a couple of members. What I'd like to do is hopefully get HB 65 members of Boards of Fish and Game. We had discussed that, talked about it. Hopefully we could just move that out.
Mr. Chairman, are you ready?
Senator Adams?
Mr. Chairman, I had objected to House Bill 65. I have looked at it. And at this time, Mr. Chairman, I am ready to move that with your blessing, please.
Mr. Chairman, I objected to it, too, as well. And I think the problem on 65 was the Section 4 was the problem had to do with setting up the board member as a person who is at a level 20A. And I still have a problem with that. It's up to the chairman what he wishes to do with it. I think we're talking about House Bill 65, right?
That is correct. It's related to membership on the Board of Fisheries and Board of Game.
The range has come down considerably. I think the testimony was that it is about $170 a day compared to $150 a day. Of course, the difference would be, unlike the rule language, it's clear now that members would get travel expenses and per diem. Before, they're not getting travel expenses and per diem. They're getting $150 and expected to pay their own per diem. So probably hasn't been a very fair compensation system.
Excellent, Bill.
Mr. Chairman, under this, then, they're going to get paid not only, they're going to get range 20A as well as getting per diem.
Regular travel and per diem.
Yeah, so they're going to be getting about twice as much as they got before. But
Well, the travel and per diem would probably compensate for out-of-pocket expenses.
I still have some concerns about it. I'm going to remove my objection.
I haven't made a motion.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Sir, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I move that Senate Resources Committee substitute for House Bill number 65 be moved out of committee with the fiscal note.
Is there further discussion?
Objection?
I'm not going to object, but I do have a problem on Section 4, and so I'm not going to change the bill at this point.
Without objection, the Senate CS for House Bill 65 moves from committee with individual recommendations and the accompanying fiscal note. There's just to make an announcement on the capital budget. Our original plan was to do SB 450, Senate bill for the capital budget. We're hopeful that the House will pass over tonight a House supplemental appropriation that would be the intention to put our capital budget onto that House vehicle. What we gain, obviously, by that is another day so that we can have a chance for, particularly on the district allocations for members, to go through their printouts, which they now have, check the language, check the amounts, so that we don't end up with a lot of technical problems on the bill. Then my hope, depending on the conference committee, would be to have printed copies of both the base and the district allocations available sometime tomorrow morning, and that we would go to Senate Finance Committee with these pieces, and hopefully bring a capital budget to the floor, you know, sometime later tomorrow. Several bills that we would like to take action on tonight would be HB 572 and SB 474, which is rolled into that bill. HB 573, another so-called fee or authorization bill, and also HB 152, establishing Alaska State Housing Commission.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Ewing.
Okay, keep going. Are you going to go down the list or just the...
Waiting for two more of our members. Hopefully, I think we're going to need people. Maybe we can go
to some of these simpler ones.
Let's go to HB 572, where we left off here.
Volume 3.
Volume 3.
572.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. In the packet is the new version of 572, the Finance CS, which we did adopt. We did adopt the Finance CS.
I think we adopted for a working draft purposes.
Yep. There's a sectional then available entitled Senate CS for CS House Bill 572, and it goes through, picks up the amendments that we did adopt. Those are labeled amendments. In addition, then I call the members' attention to the things that are bolded as HB 574. This is the language of key provisions, not all provisions, but key provisions in 574 as adopted by the State Senate Labor and Commerce Commission, Labor and Commerce Committee, reflecting their language on those things. And that would be Section 12 on APOC fees, Section 14, Department of Labor Asbestos Training Certificate fees, Section 15, Department of Public Safety, Section 22, Department of Corrections on phone services for prisoners, Section 39, new categories for park fees, 40 to 44, APUC on their regulatory costs. Section 46, Department of Administration, Telecommunications. Section 47, Corrections for Training Publications. And Section 58, Temporary Fees for 2-year duration only for state parks. Those would be, are those in the proposed new CS? Those would be things in the proposed CS for 572. And Senator Hoffman?
For clarification, did we adopt it or do we have to adopt it?
I think we have to adopt it because we have not adopted the 574 provision. Those are, most of those things are necessary for the Senate, well, now virtually the comprehensive version. Maybe we could
get a motion to adopt the commission.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move and ask the unanimous consent that we adopt the new version dated 5/10/92. Senate Committee Substitute for House Bill 572 Finance. Ask unanimous consent.
Is there objection? If not, the new CS Finance is adopted. Okay. Senator Schultz.
Okay, and Mr. Chairman, and I know that Senator Sergelisi has done a lot of work on this, and Sections 1 through 8 specifically speaks to the agencies in which they are asking for increased fees. However, when you get down to Section 26 and 27, of this, and if you will look at sections 26 and 27, you will find that it gives a broad authority throughout all state agencies to establish fees by regulation, and it gives it to all agencies, and then it gives the criteria by which they need to go through to establish those. If an agency regulates an activity or provides a service or material, or other agency is authorized to set fees for regulations for the cost of regulating the activity or providing service or material, and it goes on and on about this. I believe, personally, that this is an extremely, extremely dangerous precedent to establish in statute, where you allow all state agencies the authority to establish fees by regulation. And
Senator Schultz, I was just 26 and 27?
Yes.
Okay, just an explanation. 26, of course, the existing language is a state agency may not charge, and that really is a kind of a may not charge unless the charge is set forth in statute. It's actually restrictive, and most of that's in existing language, except for the clarification that there's other things that, it kind of clarifies what state services are.
But Section 27, in turn, kicks in. And it goes up and has an impact on Section 26 in how and what the responsibility of the state agencies are as far as establishing fees by regulation, et cetera, reporting to OMB and, budget audit and this type of thing. But the fees can go ahead and take place, and the legislature has no oversight over that. I mean, they cannot say, no, you can't do that. And I believe, at a minimum,
I would think that if we want to allow state agencies or encourage state agencies to establish fees through regulation, that those regulations, before they are adopted or accepted, should in fact come before the legislative body and be approved.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
yeah, some of this language is to trying to do that.
Right.
It's a review of fees, but then it once it once it calls for an annual report, go to LBNA, within 30 days after convening, the committee shall report the legislature the status of fee regulations, make recommendations for statutory changes. Some of that is built in to provide the review. As you know, this whole business of the legislature vetoing regulations, I mean, that's been an ongoing battle for a long time. I don't think this alters that.
Well, I do. You know, just start on page 11, or line 11. If a fee that is set by an agency by regulation does not pay for the estimated actual cost of administering the activity or providing the service or material, the agency shall adjust the fee to that level. It goes on. Well, and I read part of that. Justin,
well, you should Mr. Chairman, you should be voting against the whole bill because it's every part of this bill is going to be in.
Absolutely.
And you should be a no, a do not pass when it passes out. But, Mr. Chairman, and I probably will be too as well. But I'd like to hear at least if the number one, if we could snap through this, and I know he's got a real bee in his mind about this thing. But I'd like to hear from the Senator Sturgeliski or from somebody from her office why we're going to do this real quickly for a minute or two, and then if the administration supports it or doesn't, because they're the ones that have the administrative power. Now, I know Senator Schultz doesn't like it, so.
If I may to respond, what I was trying was getting to was down in line 23.
Yeah.
Within 30 days, that's the portion that you were talking about or the oversight that the legislature has is that within 30 days after convening of each regular session, the committee shall report to the legislature the status of the fee regulations and make recommendations for statutory changes. That's different. Okay, statutory change is one thing, but you've already given them a blanket authority to go ahead and increase fees to whatever they feel. We appropriate money to fund these people to do a job, public service work in most cases, okay? In some cases, they provide services, and sometimes they are just a regulatory agency that, you know, cause you to stay in line and within certain bounds. They are going to start charging for those kinds of things. And we are actually employing those people to do that very job. That's what we have these budgets before us, to fund those very things. To turn around and allow them the authority, a blanket authority, just to establish fees based on anything that they might do or any public service that they might provide is incredible to me. I just can't hardly believe that we would do something like that without some legislative oversight.
Well, I think I was only Senator Sturgeliski. I don't know how much of this you caught.
Unfortunately,
let me see if I can paraphrase it.
Okay.
We're on page 12 of the Senate Finance CS work with on section 27.
Okay.
And the criticism or the concerns of Senator Schultz are that we are perhaps calling on agencies to set fees for any and all purposes, and that there is little or no legislative oversight.
Mr. Chairman, matter of fact, I think that this gives us oversight in that they have to report annually. We have had these departments having the authority to set it by regulation, but we've never had a report. And as you know, the research report that we did told us where the fees were. And this means that you will have them before you annually, a report of all fees. And I think that, frankly, gives the opportunity for the legislature, not only through the regulatory process, but through the reporting process, to have the information. And as you know, most of these departments have had this authority all along, but this says that they have to annually report it. So I personally think it's a good idea to get the information, and it goes both to legislative budget and audit and then to the legislature so that it can be reviewed. So I think we have ample opportunity to, either get through the regulatory process or through this annual report.
Mr. Chairman, some of this is already existing law.
That's correct.
And when I go and look at it, it may actually be somewhat of a protection, because by reading Section 26, it says here we're just adding materials, licenses, registration, so on and so forth. And it goes on and says, for these fees, for the use of state facilities, unless the charge is set or otherwise authorized by statute. In other words, the state agency may not charge for a state service unless the charge is set or otherwise authorized by statute, or number two, where a regulation is necessary and set. And it goes on to say that it has to be the estimated actual cost of that state agency for administrating the activity. So it may be, and that's why I wanted to hear, like, from the administration as well for a minute or two, if they support this or not, who knows, and if it's really necessary.
We have, this has been circulated. We, to the best of my knowledge, have support from everyone. We did make, if you will recall, a few adjustments for public safety and retain things in statute. But it's been, to my knowledge, reviewed by the agencies, and we have no objection.
Mr. Chairman, that's fine. I don't have a problem with
that. And I talked to Paul Coons about it and their support.
Well, he stepped out.
Further questions of the of Senator Sturgis. I did see Mr. Poos in the audience. I don't know if he's just stepped out or gone.
Was I responsive to your discussion? I'm sorry, I was not on the bench. I can.
Senator, I understand, and I think that you've got some very good sections in reading through the front part of it, and you're speaking to specific agencies. I just sincerely have a distrust of not knowing enough about all of the agencies of government, and with this blanket authority telling them to do this, that it really does scare me that, in fact, you get home and someone comes up and says, you know, we've been hit with this fee increase, and you call and you think you can do something about it, and you can't.
Mr. Chairman, we did enter a report and copies were sent. For the first time with this research thing, we showed where the agencies do have that power already. This means that they now have to report it, so you'll be able to see it all in one place.
But
they have that authority.
But in many cases, it is going to take fees that are already established either by statute or by regulation.
Sure.
And where they have to go through this process, it is going to be...
They might
fine
things. They should be doing.
Well, they're already doing too much. But the thing is that when they go through and try to apply this to make it fit as far as what it's costing them to do that, we may have fees that are, you know, presently $50 that are going to be $250. I don't know. I mean, how much do you have to take into effect? I mean, how much clerical work does it take to do this and paper processing and so on and so forth? I mean, what would it take to just take anything? I mean, would there, what regulation would be adopted? It really does. It scares me, and I'm sincerely concerned about not so much Section 26 as I am about 27, which... it shows how to apply, you know, this on a statewide basis or an agency basis.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gill, if there's maybe I know we can debate this all evening. I think I'm pretty satisfied that it's okay. I don't even know if I'll be voting for the bill on the floor, but I will support the first the way it is in the Senate.
Mr. Poos, maybe there was a request for a position in administration on at least one of these sections or other sections.
52. Mr. Chairman, we support this provision. I favor a lot of it, and we do have the authority to do this in a lot of cases, but this would just really codify that, where some of this has come up is like in occupational licensing, when we looked at that. I don't want to pick on one, but I just know one example. For instance, like the psychologist paid $100 every 2 years to be licensed. Well, that nowhere comes near to paying what it costs us to run the licensing board. And although we protect the public by that, there's also major commercial value to these licensing boards and people that they can hang out their shingle or put a sign and certify it, so there is a commercial value to them. And it's just to tie to where we provide a commercial service to people to get the full cost of those fees. And I guess there could be potential for abuse, but...